I went back to visit Don Juan on May 30th, 1969, and bluntly told him that I wanted to take another crack at seeing. He shook his head negatively and laughed, and I felt compelled to protest. He told me I had to be patient and the time was not right, but I doggedly insisted I was ready. He did not seem annoyed with my nagging requests. He tried, nevertheless, to change the subject. I did not let go and asked him to advise me what to do in order to overcome my impatience. "You must act like a warrior," he said. "How?" "One learns to act like a warrior by acting, not by talking. You must completely forget the Guardian before you can again embark on the quest of seeing," he said. "How can anyone forget the Guardian? A warrior has to use his will and his patience to forget. In fact, a warrior has only his will and his patience, and with them he builds anything he wants. But I'm not a warrior. You have started learning the ways of sorcerers. You have no more time for retreats or for regrets. You only have time to live like a warrior and work for patience and will, whether you like it or not." "Well, how does a warrior work for them?" Don Juan thought for a long time before answering. "I think there's no way of talking about it," he finally said, "especially about will. Will is something very special. It happens mysteriously. There's no real way of telling how one uses it, except that the results of using the will are astounding. Perhaps the first thing that one should do is to know that one can develop the will. A warrior knows that and proceeds to wait for it. Your mistake is not to know that you are waiting for your will. My benefactor told me that a warrior knows that he is waiting and knows what he is waiting for. In your case, you know that you're waiting. You've been here with me for years, yet you don't know what you are waiting for. It is very difficult, if not impossible, for the average man to know what he is waiting for. A warrior, however, has no problems. He knows that he is waiting for his will." "Is will the control we may have over ourselves?" I asked. "You may say that it is a kind of control. Do you think I can exercise my will, for instance, by denying myself certain things?" "Such as asking questions?" he interjected. He said it in such a mischievous tone that I had to stop writing to look at him. We both laughed. "No," he said. "Denying yourself is an indulgence, and I don't recommend anything of the kind. That is the reason why I let you ask all the questions you want. If I told you to stop asking questions, you might warp your will trying to do that. The indulgence of denying is by far the worst. It forces us to believe that we are doing great things, when in effect we are only fixed within ourselves." "I've told you that when you talk, you only get confused," he said and laughed. "But at least now you know you are waiting for your will. You still don't know what it is or how it could happen to you. So watch carefully everything you do. The very thing that could help you develop your will is amidst all the little things you do. My benefactor said that when a man embarks on the paths of sorcery, he becomes aware in a gradual manner that ordinary life has been forever left behind, that knowledge is indeed a frightening affair, that the means of the ordinary world are no longer a buffer for him, and that he must adopt a new way of life if he is going to survive. The first thing he ought to do at that point is to want to become a warrior, a very important step and decision. The frightening nature of knowledge leaves one no alternative but to become a warrior. By the time knowledge becomes a frightening affair, the man also realizes that death is the irreplaceable partner that sits next to him on the mat. Every bit of knowledge that becomes power has death as its central force. Death lends the ultimate touch, and whatever is touched by death indeed becomes power. A man who follows the paths of sorcery is confronted with imminent annihilation every turn of the way, and unavoidably he becomes keenly aware of his death. Without the awareness of death, he would be only an ordinary man involved in ordinary acts. He would lack the necessary potency, the necessary concentration that transforms one's ordinary time on earth into magical power. Thus, to be a warrior, a man has to be, first of all, and rightfully so, keenly aware of his own death. But to be concerned with death would force any one of us to focus on the self, and that would be debilitating. So the next thing one needs to be a warrior is detachment. The idea of imminent death, instead of becoming an obsession, becomes an indifference. "The sole idea of being detached from everything I know gives me the chills," I said. "You must be joking. The thing which should give you the chills is not to have anything to look forward to, but a lifetime of doing that which you have always done." Think of the man who plants corn year after year until he's too old and tired to get up. So he lies around like an old dog. His thoughts and feelings, the best of him, ramble aimlessly to the only things he has ever done, to plant corn. For me, that is the most frightening waste there is. We are men, and our lot is to learn and to be hurled into inconceivable new worlds. Are there any new worlds for us, really? I asked, half in jest. We have exhausted nothing, you fool, he said imperatively. Seeing is for impeccable men. Temper your spirit now, become a warrior, learn to see, and then you'll know that there is no end to the new worlds for our vision. Don Juan did not make me leave after I had run his errands as he had been doing lately. He said I could stay, and the next day, June 28, 1969, just before noon, he told me I was going to smoke again. Am I going to try to see the Guardian again? No, that's out. This is something else. He took me to the mouth of a canyon at the bottom of the hills. It was about an hour's walk. We rested for a short while, and then he guided me through the thick desert underbrush to a waterhole. That is, to a spot he said was a waterhole. It was as dry as any other spot in the surrounding area. Sit in the middle of the waterhole, he ordered me. I obeyed and sat down. Are you going to sit here too? I asked. I saw him fixing a place to sit some 20 yards from the center of the waterhole against the rocks on the side of the mountain. He said he was going to watch me from there. I was sitting with my knees against my chest. He corrected my position and told me to sit with my left leg tucked under my seat and my right one bent, with the knee in an upward position. My right arm had to be by my side with my fist resting on the ground, while my left arm was crossed over my chest. He told me to face him and stay there, relaxed but not abandoned. He then took a sort of whitish cord from his pouch. It looked like a big loop. He looped it around his neck and stretched it with his left hand until it was taut. He plucked the tight string with his right hand. It made a dull, vibratory sound. He relaxed his grip and looked at me and told me that I had to yell a specific word if I began to feel that something was coming at me when he plucked the string. I asked what was supposed to come at me, and he told me to shut up. He signaled me with his hand that he was going to commence. I had a moment of genuine apprehension. I wanted to inquire about the reason for our being there, but he did not give me time and began plucking the string. He did it various times at regular intervals of perhaps 20 seconds. I noticed that as he kept plucking the string, he augmented the tension. I could clearly see that his arms and neck were shivering under the stress. The sound became more clear, and I realized then that he added a peculiar yell every time he plucked the string. The combined sound of the tense string and the human voice produced a weird, unearthly reverberation. Don Juan relaxed his grip and looked at me. While he played, his back was turned to me, and he was facing the southeast as I was. When he relaxed, he faced me. Don't look at me when I play, he said. Don't close your eyes, though, not for anything. Look at the ground in front of you and listen. He tensed the string again and began playing. I looked at the ground and concentrated on the sound he was making. I had never heard the sound before in my life. I became very frightened. The eerie reverberation filled the narrow canyon and began to echo. In fact, the sound Don Juan was making was coming back to me as an echo from all around the canyon walls. Don Juan must have also noticed that and increased the tension on his string. Although Don Juan had changed the pitch, the echo seemed to subside, and then it seemed to concentrate on one point toward the southeast. Don Juan reduced the tension of the string by degrees until I heard a final dull twang. He put the string inside his pouch and walked toward me. He helped me stand up. I noticed then that the muscles of my arms and legs were stiff like rocks. I was literally soaked in perspiration. I had no idea I had been perspiring so heavily. Drops of sweat ran into my eyes and made them burn. Don Juan practically dragged me out of the place. I tried to say something, but he put his hand over my mouth. Instead of leaving the canyon the way we had come in, Don Juan made a detour. We climbed the side of the mountain and ended up in some hills very far from the mouth of the canyon. We walked in dead silence to his house. It was already dark by the time we got there. I have the proper thing for you to do, Don Juan said to me as soon as I woke up the next morning. You will start it today. There isn't much time, you know. What was the string you played, Don Juan? A spirit catcher. Mine is a wild boar. When you get one, you will realize that it is alive and can teach you the different sounds it likes. With practice, you will get to know your spirit catcher so well that together you will make sounds full of power. Why did you take me to look for the spirit of the waterhole, Don Juan? You'll know that very soon. Around 10 o'clock the next morning, Don Juan took his pipe out of its sheath, filled it with smoking mixture, then handed it to me and told me to carry it to the bank of the stream. Don Juan made me smoke twice the amount I had smoked during previous attempts. At a given moment, he leaned over and whispered in my right ear that he was going to teach me how to use the water in order to move. I tried to focus my gaze on the water, but its movement distracted me. My mind and my eyes began to wander onto other features of the immediate surroundings. Don Juan bobbed my head up and down and ordered me again to gaze only at the water and not to think at all. He said it was difficult to stare at the moving water and that one had to keep on trying. I tried three times, and every time I became distracted by something else. Don Juan very patiently shook my head every time. Finally, I noticed that my mind and my eyes were focusing on the water. In spite of its movement, I was becoming immersed in my view of its liquidness. The water became slightly different. It seemed to be heavier and uniformly grayish-green. I could notice the ripples it made as it moved. The ripples were extremely sharp. And then suddenly I had the sensation that I was not looking at a mass of moving water, but at a picture of water. What I had in front of my eyes was a frozen segment of the running water. The ripples were immobile. I could look at every one of them. Then they began to acquire a green phosphorescence, and a sort of green fog oozed out of them. The fog expanded in ripples, and as it moved, its greenness became more brilliant until it was a dazzling radiance that covered everything. "Look at the water in front of you," I heard him saying. "But don't let its sound carry you anywhere. If you let the sound of the water carry you, I may never be able to find you and bring you back. Now get into that green fog and listen to my voice." I heard and understood him with extraordinary clarity. I began looking at the water fixedly and had a very peculiar sensation of physical pleasure, an itch, an undefined happiness.